Welcome to the Linux Lugcast. We are an open podcast lug that meets at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every first and third Friday of the month using Mumble. If you'd like to join us, please visit Linux Lugcast for the server details. We also have Mumble How-To on the site explaining how to configure Mumble. Then just join us in the Linux Lugcast room. During a live show, if you're unable to join us in Mumble, you can listen to us streaming live. You can also join us in IRC on Freenode at @LinuxLugcast. If you have any questions, comments, or topics you'd like us to discuss, please email us at feedback@linuxlugcast.com. We also have a Google Plus community site and a mail list. Visit our website for the direct links. Good evening, all. This is Father Finch, and I'll be your host tonight for episode 57. And with me, in alphabetical order, we have returning to us, 5150. How are you, 50?
I can't complain too much. Well, actually, I could, but you guys wouldn't be interested in hearing it.
Yeah, we like the glass is half full, 50. We also have Honky Magoo. How are you, Honky?
Doing well, thank you.
And last but definitely not least is Netminer. How's it going, Netminer? All right. So first, we're going to do some listener feedback. And a listener sent an email about our last show. Honky, do you want to take it away?
Sure. It says, "Hey guys, great show. I listen to almost every episode that you guys put on and hope you guys keep going for a long into the future. I just wanted to comment on your section about Play on Linux that Honky Magoo did on episode 56. I have been using this program for several years and have found it to be a great way to get many Windows games to run under Linux. However, it could also do much more than that. It works as a container/bottle system for Wine, making it easy for users to be able to install various Windows programs other than games, as well as being able to switch between different versions of Wine, making it easier to deal with compatibility issues and regression within Wine. It has a large database of both x86 and AMD 64 versions of Wine that you can download and use. It comes with install scripts for Windows games and other programs to create a Wine prefix for each installed program. But you can also create a Wine prefix using the GUI yourself and install Windows programs that are not specifically listed. I've used it to install Word 2007 as well as Dragon Naturally Speaking 12.5. Both programs seem to run very well using Play on Linux. If you want to, it also allows you to use the natively installed version of Wine that is on your Linux distro. Once again, thank you. Thanks a lot for a great show. Mindbender."
Yeah, he brings up some great points about how, you know, rather than directly installing through Wine, if you go through and use Play on Linux, you don't have to deal with some of the nuances of configuring Wine to be compatible.
Yeah, it seems like a very powerful program that I plan on trying out a little bit more. And like I was talking about last week, I think it might be a good fit for trying to switch like my wife over from her Windows Vista machine to something Linuxy.
Yeah, because you can maintain something that they're familiar with, you know, new converts, and then let them learn the new, especially if people are having to move from Windows 7 or XP, heaven forbid, to 10. Why not use this as a chance to get them to try something else new?
Now, is Play on Linux based on Wine, like, oh, the other one you guys talked about last week, that's paid and proprietary?
Yeah. Yes, it is, but it seems to be more of a have a lot more meta package to it, because it manages Wine at a higher level.
Crossover Linux. I mean, Crossover, that was the name of the program.
Yeah.
I didn't know about the multi-version feature. That's news to me.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
All right, well, we, Mindbender, we appreciate the feedback. Thank you. And we're going to keep on with this podcast. And if you ever feel like joining us, we're always here.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's the whole point. You guys don't have to just write in. You can just get the info from the website and jump right in some night.
All right, we're going to start with our topics now. First off, We have 5150, who, in his hiatus, has come back with a plethora of topics.
Yeah, and like I said, you guys are always welcome to put some in. I hate to be dominating the show all the time. Let me find my topics. I was messing around getting ready for the next show just a minute. One thing I will comment on at the risk of angering some of the folks out there who, you know, want us to stick to strictly Linux topics, though this is somewhat relevant because I've talked about before, you know, how getting streaming services connecting to whatever. Recently reconnected to my HBO Now account, and you guys can probably suss out why. It's because it is the time of the year for Game of Thrones. I figured get connected for 1 month and bit, you know, so I've been waiting for bated breath for a month and binge watched the first 5 of 10 episodes and worked it out. So I would, you know, it'd be about be done by the time the first month was over. But man, I gotta say, I reported on here a year ago when I first tried the HBO Now account that it was just miserable because it'd run on the device, but as soon as you tried to cast it to something, it would die. And found out everybody's still getting the same error. Well, it's better than that now, but still you have to do a whole bunch of messing with it to keep it going. It seems I guess it's like the early days maybe when you had casting Yahoo, casting Hulu, whatever, but still, they've had a year, and they don't have all the bugs worked out. You know, it will disconnect and drop, and, you know, a lot of times I've had to, you know, kill the app, at least, if not reboot the device, and then go over and hard power off the Chromecast and back on, and then try to sync everything back up. I mean, because it'll say, you know, ready to cast and all that, and then nothing or starts playing on the device. So HBO, you know, I'm paying for this stuff. You owe me a better experience than this. I think I scrolled too far the wrong way in my tabs.
So for the HBO Go app, do you have to pay separately or is that part of your subscription?
No, it's like $15 a month, just like Netflix or whatever. And on that too, I was awful disappointed. And I don't know if maybe you've had, if I'd have a better selection if I had actual HBO over cable, but it seems to me like, you know, the as far as new movies on HBO, they're just about as stale as Netflix, which is saying a lot. And I'm paying extra on my Hulu to get Showtime as well. And again, I don't think I'm getting all the Showtime brand new movies that you would get if you're a cable subscriber.
Yeah, they're probably restricted by contracts.
Yeah, and it does seem like I may try, since I'm paying for Prime anyway, and it's about the same price, what I might do is drop Showtime on Hulu and pick it up on Prime.
You expect the experience to be any different?
It looks, well, just looking at it, because you can look what movies at least there are there without subscribing on Prime. And it does seem like there's more movies that are just out of the theaters than there are on my Hulu subscription. But that may just be wishful thinking. Price is about the same. I'm not sure we do anything about it. On Allcast Planet, Archer72 says the audio sounds distorted. Anybody else in the IRC want to comment on the audio quality?
Is that for the stream?
Yeah.
All right, I'll disappear and try and tune it.
Okay, my topics. First, there's a new podcast out there. It's had a couple episodes so far. And friends of the show, it's Pokey and Taj and X1101. You probably haven't heard him unless you're familiar with the HPR book reviews. But they started their own podcast at urandom-podcast.info. And it's urandom, U as in Utah, then random, and then dash podcast. And essentially what they've come up with is they're thinking the best part of the HPR book reviews has been when we've just got so far off topic that somebody has to pull us back in. And I said, well, let's just do a show where we just do random topics. It's not necessarily open source. It's more three guys who are into technology and using open source, getting together and just talking about stuff. But a lot of it is popular media and things like that, like the recent superhero movies and books. And the last one they got back. So that kind of thing. Topics are pretty clearly listed for each of the podcasts in the show notes. So if that sounds like something, by all means, if that's something you think you might be interested in, take a listen. Second one on podcast, Hacker Public Radio needs new shows. I looked today. They said that next slot is open in 5 days. So if you've got one you've been trying, and I have like 10, I could pull out in other places and do, and have just been too lazy to get done. So, please, somebody contribute shows, or in about a week you're going to be hearing a whole lot of 5150. Okay, the next one I put, we don't usually do news events on this show, but there are a couple things I thought were going to be very important, very interesting to people who listen to this podcast. A lot of us are techs, in IT, and if we're not professionally in IT, then we're the default de facto tech support for our extended families. And to do this, one of the best tools cross-platform has always been, excuse me, man, thought I was getting better, TeamViewer. And most of us don't pay the $1,000 to purchase TeamViewer for professional use. Wow, okay. But kind of use it on the sly. And now TeamViewer says they haven't been hacked. There hasn't been a problem. But apparently a few days ago, in the middle of the night, it showed up all over Reddit that people were saying, I got up, looked at my computer, and the mouse was, somebody's in there, and the mouse was moving all over the place. And a bunch of people reported, I guess if they had stored PayPal or Amazon accounts, that those are two that they targeted, that they, the hackers went, they got on their computer, got control, and then immediately launched a browser, went to Amazon, and gave themselves a whole bunch of gift cards, up to whatever the person's credit limit was. And one of the people on there says, well, I had two-factor authentication enabled, so I don't see how that would be possible unless the hackers also made him sleepwalk and look at the text on his phone and enter the key. But if you get your PayPal password saved in Firefox, that's just not a good idea anyway. But so a bunch of people lost a bunch of real world money over this. And, again, TeamViewer says, well, they didn't come through our servers. And if you got attacked, it's because you didn't have good enough security on your system. Now, every time I've done it for a customer, I've used this, and I've had them go to you know, go to the site, download the software, run it, you know, but not the running that installs it permanently, you know, the one-time deal. You know, but still, I don't know what that leaves on the customer system. But there, you know, most of us know how TeamViewer works. It comes up, and you got to put in a session ID and a password, and those I get, you know, usually auto-generated for you, you know, so you're on the phone with the person, and their local software has come up with, you know, the copy of TeamViewer running on their system has generated a session ID and a password, numeric, and you type those in, and then you can connect to them. Now, I don't know if it's more vulnerable, you know, if you could control the TeamViewer servers, because they're actually, you know, obviously actually handling the connection. If you were on a TeamViewer server, could you go out there and just launch TeamViewer from anybody that has an account, you know, has it installed, see what the, you know, see their session ID and password on that end, and automatically get in. So that's kind of scary. And I know, well, friend of the show, I've heard him say, you know, to handle family computers, he just, you know, has the installed version of TeamViewer running on the extended family's computers. So I made sure at least he knew about it. Probably smart enough not to have it set up to automatically connect, but you don't know. Sometimes, you know, the person on the other end that you're trying to help, you know, Nana or whatever, is not even technically sophisticated enough to bring up the program and tell you the codes over the phone. You say, okay, fine, we'll just install it, so anytime my computer wants to connect to yours, it'll connect. So if that's, you know, if that's the case, if you have something set up that way, you know, I think you need to rush and do an uninstall of TeamViewer. You know, and really, unfortunately, I don't know what's cross-platform we can replace it with. Was it RPD? How I had this before the show. I should have put in the show notes. The Windows protocol. Is it RPD?
RDP.
You know, yeah, and I've used that over a network, and that works great. But of course, to get that to work, you would have to, you know, pass the port through a router and all that kind of stuff. And that's actually one technology that Microsoft invented that I actually like, because it seems to work really, really well.
It actually may work better under Linux, because things like Remina, or whatever the name of the program is, allow you multiple RDP screens, and you're not limited like you might be under a licensed Windows, where they only want one screen per system.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, I think you might have that backwards. So you can, on a Windows system, you can RDP, have multiple sessions open to different servers. But on the server, you have to buy special licensing if you're going to have multiple terminal sessions from different users. So like if you've got a Windows 7, 8, 10 box at home and you RDP into that, only one, I think those are only licensed for one active RDP session at a time. Whereas servers, you have to buy licensing, but typically you can have multiple sessions.
I remember.
That must count as one of the chairs in the system, because you know, I've never had any trouble RDP into a Windows server. And for those who are not familiar, that's usually, well, like always on a server, it's enabled by default, which would seem strange, but that's, you know, usually don't sit down console with the server. You remote into it, so they're expecting that. Whereas it's disabled by default on desktop Windows, but it can't, you know, RDP can be enabled, and then you can, you know, go from remote control one Windows box from another, or use remote desktop from Linux. And said I've done that from a Linux box into Windows Server, and it's flawless.
I remember that in order to get RDP single user hosting, I had to buy Windows 7 Pro. The client is enabled on everything, but to RDP into a Windows 7 box, you had to get the Pro version.
Okay, I wasn't aware of that. I figured just as long as you found the settings, you could turn it on and everything.
Might be true, but it's part of the magic that they gave when you did the Pro upgrade.
Okay. Next one I have, and I hate to quote a soft PD article, but essentially this is something the Solus project, and that's a if you're not familiar with Solus, that's Ike Doherty's Linux spin he's been working on for years, and it's all original. It's not based on any other projects. It's not a derivative of anything. The desktop is sort of a derivative of GNOME 2, but it's pretty much been all rebuilt from scratch. It's the Budgie desktop. But what they announced this week, they have this new tool that is going to better integrate Steam into 64-bit Linux. Essentially, I guess you might call it a shim, but it's essentially, as far as Steam is concerned, if you're running 64-bit Linux, your Steam is going to think you're 32-bit Linux. And we're going to get rid of all this problem of having two sets of libraries, a 32-bit and a 64-bit, and having a confused Steam. And I've talked about that, trying to turn this tower I have into a gaming machine that, there's got some errors found out because it was trying to hit 64-bit libraries, and you've got to delete the 64-bit library so it'll go back to or rename so it'll default to the 32-bit. And every time you update Steam, you got to go in and do that again. This is supposed to take care of that problem. Now, what I've been doing the last couple of days, I thought, well, great. There's no better way to handle this than, rather than waiting for a trickle down to other distributions, well, let's just install Solus as my Linux gaming distribution. So I reinstalled Windows because I'd screwed that up. Installed Solus, and I have to admit, man, that is, well, booting up. I put Solus on the thumb drive, DD'd it to a thumb drive, and man, I have never seen Linux boot that quickly. I mean, it was just right there at the of course. Booting off thumb drive, it bypasses login, but man, that was just right there at the desktop. And it's not a big distribution. It's made so it'll still fit on a CD-ROM. So, it doesn't come with the LibreOffice and things that do a lot of bloat. But I installed it, and there are a lot of things in Solus that are meant for the novice Linux user. And so I go through the setup, create my partitions. It just puts you into gparted to do that. And since my Windows volume is only 750 gigabyte, I said, yeah, I have that 5 terabyte hard drive I bought to put the Linux on. It's way more space than needed. So I created my home, my root, my swap, and my home, or I thought I created my home, and then I formatted a terabyte of that 5 terabyte hard drive as NTFS, just for overflow. If I filled up the 750 gig drive with games, though I don't think I ever would. I'd have another place to go. And that, you know, is prompted because I didn't have any luck putting SteamOS on the box as well. So if I might as well use the space for something. Okay, so, you know, then you assign your partitions. And what I didn't realize is, I guess it hurt before, but, you know, Solus doesn't even let you assign a home partition. It, you know, you pick root and it puts root and home and everything in there. So, you know, if you're one of those people, you got to have a partition for logs and partition for, you know, a whole bunch of different partitions. No, this doesn't even let you put a home in there. So that's what I found out later today. I went and say, oh, which, you know, make sure it didn't put home in the NTFS. Well, it didn't. It put home, you know, in the 60 gig root partition. And, you know, it's way more than you need for root, but figured might as well go a ridiculous amount. So, you know, that's put a link in the show notes if anybody knows a quick way to changing mount locations post-install. I'm pretty sure all you need to do is copy the files over to the other volume and then edit /fstab.conf and you could move where the home is. So that's probably not the biggest problem I have with it. There's some other things. I'm using Quassel for my IRC client. That package is not available. I did download the source. I'm going to try to install it from source. The other thing's really a problem for me though is SSHFS is not available, and that's what I use to mount my server volume on all my workstations. And if I was going to use this just for a gaming machine, like I originally thought, that wouldn't be such a problem. But I'm leaning more towards, you know, cleaning up my desk and using the same machine for gaming and production. And if I'm going to do that, then, you know, I've got to have SSHFS. And so I'll see if I can't install that from source. But if I, you know, if that doesn't work out, I am probably going to, you know, go back to a more mainstream distribution, and, you know, Solus announced they're gonna make packages for various, you know, of this Steam integration for other distributions. So I'll probably have to go that way. I mean, you know, My first actual taste of working with Solus, you know, Budgie, like I said, it's, you know, sort of GNOME 2 based, built from that, and it seems very much like a Mate or the other GNOME 2.
Cinnamon.
Cinnamon, yes. Seems very much like either one of those, but. And it should, because I think Ikey was one of the developers on Cinnamon back when he was attached to Mint. So, yeah, it's too bad. I mean, I really love this OS, but, you know, if it's too much trouble to get everything I need to run running, you know, I'll have to jump ship and go someplace else.
Yeah, that's what I kind of experienced when they released the 1.0 version or the initial release version. I hopped on board, threw it on a machine, and was playing around with it. And it was, like you said, lightning quick, fully, everything seemed to work out of the box. It was just the way they were managing the packages, while a great idea, it's still, you know, a good thing. They didn't have package support for some of the stuff I was looking to do.
All right. And well, I'm glad you brought up the package manager, because I did use the command line package manager. Is it EQPKG, something like that? It's unique to Solus. It's great. Seems to work just great. But I don't know if it's because I'd had that open. I mean, after I'd installed stuff, I went to the graphical package manager. Because really, that's I guess, part of Ikey's vision. He doesn't think people should have to drop down to command line to install packages. But, you know, I wanted to install LibreOffice, so I checked off all the LibreOffice stuff. And then when I went to hit apply, it didn't work. Now, is that because I'd had the CLI package manager open the same session? Would it work if I'd rebooted? But, you know, something isn't right there. Plus, you know, there's whole the graphical package manager is separated by types of software, unless it was a glitch or something, because I'd used the CLI package manager. There's whole categories of software that you click on and there's nothing there.
Yeah, I didn't experience that. I don't think I'd used the graphical package manager.
Yeah, I'm really not used to it.
May I break in here?
Please go ahead.
If you're dual booting Windows, what is your why do you have to have SSHD?
No, SSHFS. That's a utility for mounting a remote volume via SSH.
Yes, I understand what it does. I was just going to say, if you've got Windows available, WinCP, WCP will do SSH FTPs.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. I used to do that. But it, you know, I probably wouldn't, normally I wouldn't want to mount the, well, I might occasionally, but normally I wouldn't want to mount the server under Windows, just under Linux, because, you know, because I would be using the server for productivity sort of things, you know, like, well, I guess I wouldn't have to with this new machine and the huge hard drive. But I'm used to, you know, on this laptop with a 500 meg hard drive, storing everything I possibly can on the server and not storing it locally. If I start an Audacity file, it's stored on the server. If I record Mumble, I'm recording it to the server, not to the local hard drive.
Well, also, you may find, I don't know what file managers they support. There may be some that have a net mount that you can use internal to a file manager.
Well, I mean, there's other, I mean, and one thing, because it's not a mobile system, you know, I don't want to, you know, on a laptop, I don't want to put an entry in etcfstab to mount a remote volume. Where I, you know, if I have a tower system that's never going to leave the house, then yes, probably I'm better off mounting my server a different way, you know, under etcfstab.
Well, just trying to give you a way of doctoring this paradox. I may try it on on my old 486. Do they have a 32-bit version?
Oh, I can't remember if they do.
No, P4.
I'm thinking it's going to be pretty heavy for a P4.
What, Solus?
Well, I guess they don't. There's not a lot of applications on the CD, so maybe not.
What are you talking about, Solus OS? Is that available?
Yeah,
it's only available on 64.
And I don't want this to come down as 5150 does a bad review of Solus. I mean, there's a lot of things that just seem to be outstanding about it, even once it was installed on the spinning media. It booted faster than any Linux I've ever seen. It's just, you know, when it comes down to if it takes, you know, so long to sort out things that I really need to have on the system, you know, especially right now, I may have to take the path of least resistance and go a different way. But, you know, and I understand, you know, when you only have a handful of people doing development and doing packaging on the system. There's things, there's going to be things that you don't think about as being important that get overlooked. You know, it's not like they have the contributors that a Mint or a Debian or a Fedora has, you know, making sure that every package under the sun is included in the in their repositories.
Sounds like if my P4 had been like an Athlon 64, you know, single core Semipron or something, it would be a perfect system for, you know, just hacking around.
Well, it could be. If you want one, I've got a single core Semtron sitting right back here behind me.
Well, I'm just saying, if I had that instead of the P4 system, which is 32-bit limited, early 64-bitters would probably run just fine with that. But then again, I'm just browsing the web and not doing too much productivity stuff.
Now, that was another thing, and it may be just my early impression. See, and again, it's because they have a limited amount of resources as far as manpower to work with. It seemed like maybe, you know, they didn't not, they may have picked one application to do one job, and then there might, you know, where under a lot of distributions you would have, you know, 5 or 10 different applications to do that same job that would be packaged, that maybe there weren't a whole lot of as many alternatives in the repositories. And like I said, this is from, you know, looking at it for 3 hours off and on. So I may be completely off the mark on that one.
Well, also, it sounds like this is a new distro, so it may be just in the 2 or 3 leaf state.
Yeah, this... Well, it kind of been working on it for a while, but it's in the current incarnation. Probably, you know, year and a half they've actually been working on it. Tell you what, guys, I will be back in just a minute.
So has anybody else played with the Bungie desktop? Because you can get that desktop on other distributions.
I have not, but if I can get it under Ubuntu, I may try it for my... my 32-bitter, something lighter than XFCE.
Yeah, so back to almost, what, the beginning of the year when that person asked us to review Gecko Linux, I downloaded the Bungie version, and he's right. It's very Cinnamon-esque. It's like a cleaner version of Cinnamon. It's really nice looking.
I remember I was following Ikey Doherty on Google Plus when he was tweaking the UI for Bungie. It just the amount of detail where he would switch stuff, and I really, I don't have an eye for that kind of stuff, so I wasn't able to see the differences between the pictures of what he was showing. But just that, you know, he was doing these little itty-bitty tweaks and modifications, and he was just spending so much time. He really, really worked hard at it, and it looks good. It shows. But it's not my type of desktop environment.
Well, I'm just looking to stretch old hardware, so very, very lightweight, maybe what saves my bacon.
I'd say as far as lightweight, probably both FXCE and LXDE are going to come in lighter. And actually right now, because nothing else seems to work on my OpenSUSE, you know, I'm running IceWM. And other than one program that won't run under it, which is one I really need when I'm making up SD cards and stuff, it's Gparted for some reason won't launch at all. But other than that, you know, I think it's probably lighter than any desktop that, you know, we're working with. And unlike, was it open? You know, when you install a program, it actually shows up in the menus. You don't have to manually edit the menu to get things to show up. So, other than the one problem I've had with it, I've, you know, it's been more than satisfactory.
Is there any way to download the programs and compile them by source?
Well, yeah, that's one thing I'm going to try to do before I give up. I don't know. I assume there's probably a Git repository for SSHFS someplace. There was, I've already downloaded the binary source for Quassel client. So, I'm going to see. And a lot of those, anytime I've compiled stuff before, it's just been like paint by numbers. You use the instructions on the website and either it works or it doesn't. And which is a ridiculous thing. I spent 3 years in college or 2 years compiling C programs, and I understood all that stuff back then. And that, now that I'm having to do it for Linux, it's like I've got to have an instruction key to get it right. But, usually when things drop into Git repositories, they assume you know what you're doing trying to compile the program. And
just for your general knowledge, I think Bulgy is available even under FreeBSD or the BSDs.
Cool. Like I said, it's a beautiful desktop. I love it. Like we said before, it looks like a cleaner version of Cinnamon.
Well, if I can get it in a 32-bit package, I may try it on one of my 32-bitters.
Like I said, if you're going for lightweight, I rather suspect LXDE or FXCE are both going to be more lightweight.
Again, I'm pretty sure that even Bungie is just a 64-bit.
Yeah, that's what the operating system is, that's what I would expect that Budgie is. Okay, and
anyone ever do anything with LXQT?
Very, very briefly.
Well, I tried. Like I said, I think that's what OpenSUSE has, LXQT rather than LXDE now, and I've had very poor luck trying to install alternate desktops on this system. Like I said, it started out KDE working fine till it didn't. ISWM is a fallback. It's fortunate that was on there, or I would have had to do something different with this computer by now.
Yeah, I found I'm running Mint on a couple of my machines, and I found trying to switch desktops on that was a pain.
Okay. Go on to my projects that I was, and the links for this, they're in the show notes. The whole thing on TeamViewer, there's a link in the show notes. The URandom podcast, there's a link in the show notes. And the Softpedia article on the Better Steam integration is also in the show notes. Okay, but I know some people are probably expecting me to continue my report on the spring cons that I attended, but I was trying to experiment this week, and I really wanted to talk about that while it was still fresh in my mind. And this came about kind of the debate that was on TLLTS, the Linux Leak Tech Show, not this last one, though this week's was sort of a follow-up, but a week before that, Lord D, who's been on the show several times, was talking about the offerings from Purism, and that's PURI.SM is the URL, and they've got several Kickstarters going. And they've got a couple laptops. They're saying, they are hardened against various organizations spying and tracking you, and they have a true Linux tablet. I think there's both 11-inch and 10-inch tablets, and they're running full-blown Linux. They actually have full-blown SD not SD. Well, they have SD cards, but full-blown USB and RJ45 ports, among other things. They have switches so you can turn them on and off, just like on a laptop, you know, physical switches to turn off interfaces. So, and I got sort of in the middle of the argument. Lord D was saying, you know, was kind of arguing a little with Dan. Dan, like me, has recently purchased a Jitty Ultra tablet running Remix OS. And, you know, if you caught me 2 or 3 years ago, I would have said, yeah, I don't want a tablet or a phone that runs Android. I want real Linux. But then we got the Chromecast. We got all the streaming services. And really, you know, I find a lot of what I use the tablet for is as a TV remote. You know, I go on one of the streaming apps and I throw it over to the TV. And the nice thing about the Jitty tablet is with the attached keyboard and the stand and all that, you can use it as a little laptop running Android. I don't do a whole lot of content creation, but at least I can consume social media like G+ and Facebook at the same time I'm watching TV, maybe send a few emails, stuff like that. And the point of contention really between Lord D and Dan says, well, you know, the streaming stuff, the Android apps do it so much better. You throw it up there and it's full screen and it just works. And Lord D was saying, well, yeah, but that's, you know, it's not a true, you know, it's closed source software on top of a Linux kernel, just like a Mac is closed source software on top of BSD, you know. And if you were true to your ideals, it would not be a hardship to bring up the streaming service on in a browser and then throw the browser up on your TV. You know, you got some borders and stuff, but if you were truly into open source, that would be a very small sacrifice. And I can see both sides of the argument. I'm more of Dan's. You know, the apps generally. My complaints before the show about HBO Now aside, the apps generally work fairly well, really, really well. Occasional glitches you got to deal with, and you know, being a technical person, that's not such a hardship for me. I can see where some non-tech people, first time they had a glitch with Chromecast, they say, "Oh, let's throw this thing away." But so I looked into, is there a middle ground? Where is the technology on running Android apps on the Linux desktop? And there are a couple competing solutions, neither one which seems to be quite perfect. So I guess I'm going to have to open a window here. So let me let up on the key. The first one is called Archon. And with Archon, what you're doing, you remember last year came out that Chrome had some limited support for running Android apps. I think you were limited to 4. I'm not sure if you still are. But in the show notes, this Linux.com article, you know, really tells you everything you need to know to get Archon running. And I'll just go through the steps here real quick. I didn't, you know, no reason to put them in the show notes because you just go right to the link and read them. And the first thing you need to do is install the developer version of Chrome. The nice thing about that, you know, nice thing about Chrome is if you do these different versions, they'll install alongside each other. I don't mean Chrome and Chromium as different versions, but well, originally I think to get Chromecast working, or no, not Chromecast, but Netflix. When we had all this stuff about, oh, we got to get Netflix working under Linux. You know, it wouldn't work with the you know, Chrome that you go to Google and say download Chrome, you had to get the developer version. This is the same thing. So you go to the, make sure you get the dev version of Chrome, and the article tells you how to get there, and install that. And then you install the Archon add-on into Chrome. Now then you have to go over to your Android device to install your APK or grab your APKs. So pretty much you still have to have an Android device to do this. There are sketchy places out there on the internet that say, here's the APK for this, here's the APK for that. And I guess if you didn't have an Android device, you'd take your chances that way. There's an app called, coincidentally, called Archon Packager. And, you know, you run that, shows you all your apps, you pick the app that you want to convert. And it doesn't really generate, I think it generates like an expanded APK. You know, like APK is a sort of a compressed package. What you get is actually everything expanded out. But it gives you an APK zip file. But then when you extract the zip, it's not just one file with an APK extension. It's like a folder worth of stuff. So, you know, you manipulate, use a file manager. Like ES file manager on Android to copy, you know, the zip file over to your hard drive on your Linux box, and then you extract it, and then you go back into the developer version of Chrome, and you go to the they call it the overflow menu. It's the three bars. You know, it's just the config menu for Chrome. And go to tools dash extensions. Click load unpack extension. Navigate to wherever you unpack that package, and click on the folder that was created when it was unpacked. You click open. And then to run the app, in the upper right-hand corner of developer version of Chrome, there's an icon labeled apps. So you click on that, and then your app should be in there. Okay, I kind of had success. I brought Hulu over. I could run Hulu, log in with my account, and then I got the Hulu app running in about the center third of my screen. And I could watch Hulu there. But there wasn't any icon to click on for casting. So, okay, fine. I said, we'll bring over the Chromecast app. I did that. Tried to run it. And it said, I need the Play Store updater. So that, you know, if you go into the Archon Packager, that doesn't show up because that's a core pre-installed app. But I did find things that would, you know, convert alternate ones that would convert to an APK, and you know, I did that with the Play Store updater, and I think it didn't create a file, or when I brought the file over, it wasn't recognized or whatever. So that was fail there, and I'm wondering if in the inside Chrome, that if one app could actually even talk to another app, if that wouldn't have been fail. I also tried to, I installed Netflix as well. Netflix, you click on Netflix inside Chromium, and it does a splash screen, and then it disappears. So, you know, if anybody's had success, I'd like to hear from anyone who's had success, you know, running a Android app from the Linux desktop, especially somebody that's got it to work with the Chromecast and actually stream. Okay, so I put the Archon aside at that point, and the alternative seems to be a little more complicated, and that one is the, and man, I'm not sure if I could pronounce that right, Shashlik. For one thing, it's only packages for Debian based and Arch. So I tried to compile from the source, and like we were discussing earlier, you know, when they give you the source code and then the step-by-step instructions compile, and if that doesn't work, I no longer have the knowledge to fix it. At one time I may have, when I was compiling my own C code, I probably ought to start doing that again, and then I would regain that sort of knowledge. But that didn't work. But I had seen several places say, well, if you got the deb file, you can just use Alien to convert it to an RPM and install it in, you know, CentOS Red Hat, Fedora, OpenSUSE. They all use the same RPM. Now, I don't think all RPMs are the same. If you go over on the Mandriva side of things, I don't think, you know, that's compatible. But OpenSUSE is apparently close enough to Fedora, Red Hat, etc. to usually use the same RPMs. Trouble is, Alien's not in the repository. At least not in the normal one. But OpenSUSE has this weird install from the internet option that is closer, you know, it's as close as anything to a PPA for Ubuntu or the AUR for Arch, you know, as anything else. It's just, it uses a web interface. You go to a website, you click on install this, and it does. So, got Alien installed. First, I've heard of it before, never used it before. And, you know, converted the deb to an RPM, and it just, that just worked fine. I used Zyper to install the RPM, you know, sudo Zyper install, well, sudo Zyper IN RPM name, that worked. But then when I tried to bring over Hulu and install it using the commands outlined in that CNX software link that I have, then the Hulu app noped out at that point. And what it was supposed to do, unlike running it under, you know, a browser, like it would have been, or like it was in Archon, actually what Shashlik is supposed to do is it installs it right there in your menu. Now, part of the problem was, I guess Shashlik is only been successfully tested under KDE. And I figured, well, we'll try. You know, because even though my KDE isn't working on this system, all the libraries are there, so it might work. So, you know, somebody running KDE might have a more better success story. So some, you know, very much would like somebody to, if they successfully use either of these programs or another method for running Android apps under a Linux desktop, I'd appreciate some feedback. Now, the other thing, the other suggested ways to get it running is install the Android Developer Kit and run your apps under that, because it's essentially an emulator, and or use VirtualBox and install a real Android under VirtualBox, the Remix OS. for, you know, the Remix OS 4x86 was suggested as the perfect way to run Android apps. So, you know, I didn't have that much time right now for experimentation. That's probably the next direction that I might check out. But if somebody knows a successful way for running Android apps under the Linux desktop, please reply with feedback. And I'm going to see if anybody has any questions.
No question. I just wanted to mention that I tried ArcWelder a while back. One of my first attempts, if you listen to last week's show, of trying to put on the game Hearthstone onto my computer was using ArcWelder, and I had zero success with that.
I'm glad to see you guys are still there. I always have this vision when I go on one of these long soliloquies, is the scene from Airplane where the guy just talks and talks and talks, and you look back in the cabin and people are hanging themselves. So,
nope, nothing like that.
We really missed you last time when you were out carousing with your friends.
And it's in the show notes, but let's... Honky has some subjects, so I would say let's kick the discussion of the Linux Fest forward another show.
That sounds good.
Sorry. Mine was just real quick. I had seen this, I believe, yesterday, and I figured it would be something that our listeners would be interested in. I know we don't do a whole lot of news on this show, but I thought it was worth bringing up. I put two links in the show notes. The first one is the blog post from, and I got to get the guy's name. I don't have the guy's name. Either way, there is a group of people from the OwnCloud project, and I believe it's right here at the very top. Project Frank Christoph, Lucas, Arthur, Morris, Bjorn. Those are some of the people who are leaving the OwnCloud project to fork it and create a project called... it was just here. This is what I get. Oh, Nextcloud. Jesus. I'm looking right at it. Ah, getting tired. Sorry. Nextcloud. Basically, they are unhappy, but actually it really doesn't go into much detail as to why. I think it was because they felt the project wasn't going in the right direction, or the direction that they wanted to go into, and that the company wasn't listening to the needs of the supporters, the people involved with it. So they decided to leave and fork it and start Nextcloud. And immediately the next day, or less, OwnCloud responded, and that's the second link I put in the show notes, and said that they're still going to power on and do what they do, but the last paragraph says, unfortunately, the announcement has consequences for OwnCloud Inc., based in Lexington, Mass. Our main lenders in the U.S. have canceled our credit. Following American law, we are forced to close the doors of OwnCloud Inc. with immediate effect and terminate the contracts of 8 employees. The OwnCloud GmbH is not directly affected by this, and the growth of the OwnCloud Foundation will remain a key priority.
Yeah, I'd seen that earlier today about them closing the U.S. office, and I was like, I was kind of surprised that they had an office to close.
Well, they do support for it. It's kind of like a boot Red Hat, where they have, the free version, and then they have a version for, proprietary, but for big companies and stuff like that, that they do support for.
Yeah, that was the trouble. The gist of it was that, like OwnCloud, didn't they just recently partner up with Western Digital to provide a solution for, building your own cloud in your home and having access to storage and stuff? And there was a Community Edition, and that's the one that most of the people were using to build all their stuff on the side.
Well, right. I think the majority of us are our own tech support, not willing to pay somebody else to support it. And I don't know if does OwnCloud really have a whole lot of application for enterprise.
Yeah, it's there's a lot there for enterprise. I mean, it's between, you know, it's almost like it has its own almost like Google Docs where you can edit documents in it. It has its own calendaring system. It has its own contact system. It has its own, obviously, file sharing. There's a lot of other plugins, I think, for it. There's a lot of things you can use it for, and I believe there are several big enterprises that actually use or rely on OwnCloud.
Now, can you access it all from Windows, or do you have to have a Linux client?
You can do it in a web browser if you want. You remember we used to use OwnCloud, right?
Right.
Yeah, you can do it. You can either, there is plugins for file managers, and which I haven't used, but there is an Android clients, and the big thing that I've usually used is the web interface for it.
Would be a pretty sickly cloud if it didn't have web access.
True. But it's got a very nice web UI. It's a little slow. I guess it really all depends on which system you're running, but it's a really nice, it's really slick looking interface.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how this affects the whole Western Digital deal, if that just becomes vaporware. I don't know if they were shipping those yet or not.
I don't think that's going to go away. I mean, that would be, they seem to have, if they had a contract with Western Digital and OwnCloud is still going to be a thriving company, according to the first half of this post by OwnCloud, then I don't see that going away. I mean, if it looks like certain people want to expand more of the community edition over the enterprise edition. From what I gather, they seem to be more. They think that the needs of the community aren't being met, and that they're too focused on the enterprise or something along those lines. So they decide to fork, and it just seems to be more of a fork of the community edition. So that's just going to be its own separate entity. What I'm really hoping is that this would create almost like a little competition. They would both start creating better things. And, I mean, a little competition always helps, you know, helps push things forward.
Actually, well,
exactly.
reminds me of what happened to create Fedora back in the day. When Red Hat went all corporate, somebody decided, we're going to have a community edition.
So did Red Hat start out as a bunch of mavericks? Because it seems like it's very tightly, I'm sorry, Fedora started as a bunch of mavericks. It seems like, you know, today they're very heavily integrated into Red Hat.
I'm just saying back in the day, what Red Hat has taken Fedora back under its wing, but back in the day it was the community version of Red Hat, because Red Hat had dropped all support for the retail desktop.
Now, these people left to form Nextcloud, is this like their best talent or something? Or is it just, they could see them walking out the door and their backers lost it? Or, you know, just that maybe this is the one of these things that has been tried to be monetized because, you know, people's kids got to eat. And like with so many attempts by Canonical before, finding there hasn't been this clear path towards monetization.
I don't know. It didn't really, the OwnCloud statement didn't really give any details as to why or who their main lenders are or why they backed out. I mean, in the blog post set up, put out by the guys setting up Nextcloud, they refer to themselves as some of the top contributors to OwnCloud, to OwnCloud Core. So it may, or that more contributors from the two more of the top contributors from OwnCloud Core are joining them. So it seems like a lot of the bigger people, the bigger programmers there are the ones who left, or so that might have scared somebody off, so the contributors off. I don't know. It seems to me that whoever their contributors were kind of made a hasty decision, because you don't know what tomorrow may bring, and it's only been a day, and Nextcloud hasn't put anything out yet. So, I mean, to jump ship like that seems kind of, I don't know, that seems kind of early to be jumping ship, don't you?
Of course, it is open source. They could, yeah. Even if Nextcloud puts out something superior, OwnCloud can always just copy the code, you know, incorporate the code back into what they have, of course. But, you know, as far as development, that always puts them, that kind of philosophy always puts them behind Nextcloud.
Sounds like their finances had a hair trigger eject button.
Yeah, exactly.
I would think if everything was solid over there at OwnCloud, that, you know, their backers wouldn't have jumped ship in less than a day.
Yeah, that would be...
You don't know what kind of heads up the backers got.
Right. I was going to say, you don't know whether this was something that was a long time coming, or it's been building for a while, and just one day, all of a sudden, you know, it's just yesterday that everybody else found out about it. It's just something that's been brewing underneath the surface at internal at OwnCloud.
Also, if you were really pissed, which is clear by this, at your former employer, you're walking out the door, after all, giving up whatever paycheck they were going to give, mining things with his bank would be a great... to heck with you. Talking to the bank...
Is this clear whether these were paid employees at some point, or were these... because I expect that was only the 8 people in the shop, but, OwnCloud's been probably, you know, getting great contributions from just hobbyist contributors, you know, people who aren't getting a paycheck to develop OwnCloud.
And they may have worked something out where they are getting some funding, considering the end of this last statement. So I'm going to go ahead and read the first statement from the Nextcloud people. It says, "So today is the day we announce that we're forking our own cloud. At some point the coming weeks, we include project founders Frank and the core OwnCloud contributors who publicly quit OwnCloud Inc. over the last weeks. Lucas, Arthur, Morris, Bjorn, Jan, Christopher," I think Jan Christopher was one name, "and quite a few others as well who can't talk about that yet. As of now, most of the top contributors to OwnCloud Core are joining, and of course, we are busy hiring and aim to leave no man/woman behind." If they're busy hiring, then they have to have some sort of financial backing.
Well, not to mention that they are taking the paid employees with them.
They're taking some, obviously, but then, like, the ones who weren't... who weren't part of the ones leaving were part of the 8 that were left and fired up in their office up in Mass, Lexington.
Kind of reminds me of the whole Linux Voice mutiny, is probably not the right word, Linux format thing a couple years ago.
That's the first Exodus thing that came to my mind, too. Exodus, that's good.
Also, it would be nice to know who's financing the Nextcloud people. Could be that the bankers for OwnCloud in the U.S. decided to change horses without telling the horse.
Well, right. Obviously, if they're hiring, they must have some sort of financial backing from somewhere.
I think the only thing I can say is I hope whatever comes from this, that they can... I think OwnCloud is an excellent product. And if somebody else forks it, I hope they do as much of a good job, as much of a, they do as good of a job with it. But I think one of the big things that it is lacking is they need to kind of clean it up so it runs a little bit smoother. like I said, with the web UI and whatnot, it runs kind of like the best way to run it is not using the web UI and to use the one of the plugins or something like that, because then it's you're just basically using it as like a syncing. But it's got a really nice web UI, but it's very rough to use. I mean, there's got to be a way to make it so, you know, the pages render a little bit cleaner and it just runs a little bit smoother. So I'm hoping that's what I'm looking forward to, that that's one of the first things that somebody tries to do is try to make it run a little bit smoother.
Basically, well, you're looking for a LibreOffice version.
Correct.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a complaint I've always heard about OwnCloud, that, you know, gets the job done, but it's occasionally a little janky in spots.
And I'm hoping that the original OwnCloud people can stick around just to create a little bit of competition to be able to try to force people to actually, you know, clean it up so it doesn't, you know, it isn't janky in spots.
Well, I mean, that certainly rises all boats.
Well, it reminds me a lot of what happened with, what was it, OpenSSL. When LibreSSL came out, OpenSSL started cleaning up its act.
Well, I thought everybody pretty much switched over to LibreSSL.
Well, a lot of people did, but I'm just saying that it was a motivation for the other guys to give them a big kick in the seat.
I think it wasn't other guys. I think it was other guy, like one dude. I mean, that's where that's the trouble. You know, the whole web running off this package is essentially, you know, one guy who could get hit by a bus someday.
May I assume that the OwnCloud topic is closing?
It most certainly is.
I just looked up something. One of the new Ubuntu's coming out in the fall officially is Budgie Ubuntu.
Is it 64?
And 32.
Really?
It's even available now on as a PPA or something you can add to 16.4. That's one of the things I might do, is just throw it on my other machine, which was originally Mate, and have it as an alternative desktop.
See, I thought Ikey was only programming for 64-bit. I think that's awesome that if they have a 32-bit version.
Well, he may have been, but there's the people in the community clearly wanted it to go to a more mainstream foundation.
I'll have to check that out.
I mean, this can be installed on anything that will accept an Ubuntu desktop.
Oh, that might have been the pre-show. You were talking about the 25-mile range Wi-Fi.
Yes, Ubiquiti Networks 25-mile. It's a couple of dishes with PPOE point-to-point focused dish effective. 25 kilometers, about 13 miles.
Okay, that's right. You said kilometers.
This is via Linux Tech Tips, one of their special reviews. They said it worked great, except when they tried it across the highway, the traffic caused problems with their network connection.
You'd think they'd be enough above the traffic not to matter.
They were doing stuff at street level with some very skanky sort of mounts.
Okay, well, I know the, you know, technically 2.4 and 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi is supposed to be good with big enough directional antennas, you know, ones that look like a barbecue grill, for 10 miles. But I expect that would have to be with a perfect focus on each end, and I'm not sure exactly how you would accomplish that.
Well, part of what they have, and I don't know what, is that every system has a power level tuning and focus tuning add-on. So you're basically supposed to set the thing up and tune it with laptops at each end or laptops at one end, and, you know, you're aiming it at the right site by how much signal you get. And, you know, adjusting it that way.
Well, that's exactly how every time, you know, my provider was originally 5 gigahertz, and then they went to WiMAX. And when they've set those up, that's exactly how they've done it is, you know, they go up there and they have a laptop that tells them how much signal they're getting. And, you know, in the same way they're on the phone to the guy on, you know, the guy at the center of the network, going back and forth, say, you know, and making micro adjustments to the aiming of the antenna until they get something they're satisfied with.
I think it's basically trying to do WiMAX, and I believe this is 5 gig too.
Well, because when, you know, I knew tree lines would, well, I knew they blocked the 5 gigahertz signal. I don't know if the WiMAX is less susceptible, but, you know, when they put the antenna up on top of this house, and it goes, of course, it's a berm house, so it's, you know, it's down in the hill, but they've got about a 10-foot pole they attach to the top of the house, and they put the patch panel on top of it, and, you know, do the aiming. And we discussed on the show that I had thought, you know, well, I don't have line of sight from the house, but I can go, you know, a couple hundred feet up the hill and have line of sight to where the antennas are. And I thought I was going to have to, you know, bury a cable in the ground and then put a pole, you know, high enough so that the cattle couldn't rub on it and attach the antenna up there. They came out and said, no, let's see if we can't get it from the house. You know, I'm certain if I climbed up on the peak of my roof, you know, it's not high enough to see the other end line of sight. But, you know, WiMAX must be able to power through that.
Well, I've heard that there's, with high frequencies, there's a little tiny bit of surface following. That's why the big drive-in style radars were able to do very long-range tracking.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Well, one of the things over in Chernobyl area is actually one of Russia's old Cold War huge radar arrays. Saw that on YouTube.
Okay, well, I bet they pick up a bit of interference now.
Well, what surprised me is that Chernobyl may be a bigger tourist attraction now that it's empty than it was when it was a living city.
Well, yeah, you can, you know, long as you don't spend more than a day there or something, you can slough it off. I'm not sure if that that would be something I'd want to do, but I'm very interested in, you know, when I see those guys on YouTube, you know, go through there.
Just for your information, according to the Linux Tech Tips, the pair of dishes, pole mounts, 2 PoE injectors, one to power each transceiver, and even a weatherproof cover, goes for $150. I don't know if that's Canadian or U.S. It's a Ubiquiti Networks Powerbeam.
Sounds about right. What I spent on my directional antennas, you know, the old place, and not to beat a dead horse again, you know, but you know the antenna. Yeah, I couldn't have got it attached to my house, but it was attached to an outbuilding. And then I did 2.4 gigahertz from there to where I live. And, you know, the original patch panel I had was, I'm pretty sure it was $80 off of Newegg. And the reason I got that is same provider, well, it's not the same provider, but a provider was providing to the local co-ops, and they said, well, yeah, if you can hit them over there, you know, where we've got the downlink to the office, you know, we'll give you an account. Well, not give you an account, sell you an account. But it was behind a whole bunch of concrete, so that didn't work. But I still, you know, when I got the, eventually got a broadband connection, I had that patch panel, and then I'd bought one, I think it's Pacific Wireless, which doesn't exist anymore. And it was one of those that looks like a barbecue grill with a, you know, a stick in the center. And it wasn't anywhere near that distance. It was maybe 300 yards between the buildings. But, you know, put the patch panel up on the side of the outbuilding and just had the barbecue grill one in my attic because it's a wood building. So, you know, the wall was, you know, invisible to the wireless. And pointed it pretty much in the general direction of where the patch panel was. And at that distance, you didn't have to be that accurate. And it worked just fine.
One of the nice things that this has, the transceiver is in the center of the dish, of course. I mean, all of the power guts are up there on the end of the pole. That's how come it's PoE, power over Ethernet, for those who may not know what that is. And it has on the transceiver, it has a signal power lighting, a little strip, LED strip bar of how much power it's putting out or receiving. So you can get a little information straight off of the device instead of having to necessarily go down to your laptop.
Yes, the way, both iterations of the Wi-Fi that I've had from my provider, PoE, so you just have an Ethernet cable running up to, you know, the transceiver and everything is built into the antenna, so it's just this box up on the roof. And two or three times, not since I've been in this house, but the old place had close enough lightning strikes to blow up the PoE box and had it replaced. And about after the second time, they said, no, you're not grounded right. And I should have been in that because it's a new building. You know, if you're going to get hit by lightning that much, you're going to have to pay $60 each time one of these things blows up.
I think they were saying, please put in a lightning rod somewhere.
Yeah, and I bought the stuff for it, never got it done. I did get a big copper rod, but I never got it mounted. But it did get to the point where I just said, you know, okay, give, you know, they gave me free ones, I will pay, you know, for another one so that the next time my internet blows up, you know, I don't have to drive into town or be down all over a weekend. You know, I'll just, replace it and then settle up with you for the next one.
So you had a hot spare available. That's good.
Okay, we've lost Father Finch. So, you know, probably we've beat this one to death. Don't you think, Netminer?
Oh, yes. Time to put this dead horse back in the closet.
Okay, this has been Linux Lugcast, episode 57, and I'm not your host, but I'm 5150, and we've been joined by Honky Magoo.
Good night, all.
And Netminer.
Good night, folks, and best wishes, Father Finch, wherever you are.
SMLR 2.0 is the revamped Sunday Morning Linux Review with Tony Bemis, Mary Tomich, and Tom Lawrence. On even episodes, we cover distro fever and tech news. On the odd episodes will be fresh looks where we review a distro or software or tips and tricks. Live recordings are bi-weekly. Sunday morning on both Google Hangouts on air and audio-only stream. Visit smlr.us for all the shows and the live recording schedule.
The Linux Link Tech Show. Tune in to the world's longest-running Linux podcast live every Wednesday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Find us on the web at www.twlts.org or email us at techshow@thelinuxlink.net. IRC server, thelinuxlink.net /techshow. Join Pat, Alan, Link, and Joel. And don't forget, the two Dans. They are so hot. I know, because I've kissed them both. And Blindridge, he's a bloody drunko.
If you don't like cats, you can get up your ass. Ain't no fuddy duddies at a Lincoln Bath.
G'day, my name's Jude, or better known as Mrs. 64. Hacker Public Radio needs your help. They're running out of shows. If you ever thought you'd like to contribute or do a podcast yourself, here's your chance. Come on, Hacker Public Radio needs you. If you think you're going to sound silly or not going to sound like you know what you're doing, think again, because it never seems to stop my husband. It's easy, and if you live in the USA or the UK, it's as simple as picking up the telephone and phoning the call-in number to record a show, or plugging in a mic and opening Audacity. Get over to hackerpublicradio.org/contribute.php.